Bob Hoy has advised institutional clients for 30 years at least as editor in chief investment strategist of institutionaladvisors.com. It's just a pleasure to have him back with us today. How's the weather in Vancouver?
Well, we had unusually cool weather and snow for a while. But the warm weather with the rains came in the other day. I kind of call it the Maui monsoon. But there's been a lot of good snow up in the mountains for skiing. So, but as I say, Vancouver is sort of Canada's banana belt, and of late we don't get much snow in the city at all. So it was 3 or 4 weeks of unusual amounts of snow.
I'm sure the skiers are enjoying that, although I bet you all are much better prepared for heavy snowfall than we are in the Appalachian.
Oh, no, not too much Vancouver, because when it comes, it's sort of close to the freezing point, and it's slippery no matter where you live. But I think a lot of people have all-wheel drive cars, snow tires. You can get around all right that way.
Well, we've had an unseasonably warm winter here, and we're...
Oh, yeah, you had that pulse of... But around the world, it has been cool. Like in Siberia, there was 80 below Fahrenheit.
I was talking to an acquaintance from the Windy City, and we were noting how once the temperature gets below zero, it's difficult to differentiate between, you know, zero and minus 20, minus 30, minus 40, just cold.
It's bleeping cold indeed. But I think Moscow, they had a low temperature, I don't know, minus 25 Fahrenheit, and that was the coldest in well over 100 years.
In 2017, the precious metals are off to a relatively solid start, up 4% or so. Do you expect these solid times to persist, or will the U.S. dollar continue in its upward trajectory?
Well, on the gold sector, because, you know, I sort of focus on the gold shares themselves, because when you're in a post-bubble contraction, one of the features has been that the senior currency becomes chronically firm against most other currencies and most commodities for most of the time, is the way I like to put it. So I can't get excited about silver or gold being traded in U.S. dollars. You have a problem there. But Mother Nature has a way of making the gold business very profitable in a post-bubble contraction. The main thing is that the real price of gold, it firms up. So gold is firming up relative to, say, energy costs. So if you're a miner and you've got a good control on your energy costs and you're getting a decent price for gold, you're going to make money. So we look at the gold sector as an investment in gold shares. Trading gold and silver in U.S. dollars is for traders. I don't see any huge amounts of money being made on it. Well, we are in a cyclical bull market for gold shares, of which it has had the first serious and significant correction. If you recall, last summer in July, we noted all the excesses in the sector and called for a significant correction. And then in November, we're outlining it. It was almost just like November the previous year that we wanted to see the gold shares, we use the Huey, begin to outperform the bullion price, set a base, which it did, and then it broke out, and that was the blessing. It's a cyclical bull market for gold. It could run for some time, basically on improving earnings for the sector, which gets us back to looking at it as an investor. And the other thing about these post-bubble contractions, and just to put it in perspective here, Chris, this is the crash ended in 2009, and it was a classic crash because it had followed a classic bubble. Then you've had a long but weak expansion in the economy and a very long bull market in stocks. All of the excess credit that central bankers have been pushing into the markets haven't been stimulating the economy which is their peculiar theory, but we've taken that theory apart for decades, that that's a correlation on credit expansion and a business expansion, not a causation. And so anyways, this now is getting long in the tooth, the economic expansion. But we note that, you know, it's sort of got firmer since June. So we've been calling it the positive wave, and that as part of the positive wave, you've had the Brexit referendum vote in England to separate from the authoritarian Europe, and you've had the then in November the U.S. election, which is a move to end the authoritarian experiment that's been running in Canada or in the U.S. So this is very constructive, but and you had, like you had, even though they rigged the numbers, the GDP figure for the third quarter was good. That's the end of September. And so things are generally pretty good. Now, what has happened is that with the Trump win, this is the most remarkable political change, I think, in American history, because you went from the most authoritarian experiment in U.S. history with the Obama administration to now a non-politician, Trump, heading up the next government in American history. So it's very dynamic times. So this has prompted like small business confidence, various things like that, to jump up to the highest since November 1980. When Reagan won that key election and then started a pro-business administration, which, of course, was fought and thwarted by Democrat Congress and the Democrat Senate. So, but on this one now, with the Republicans, as I read, are in the strongest position since the 1920s, They will be able to affect policy. The left, the authoritarians, will fight it. As we've seen already, it is nasty out there because the left just doesn't like to lose. But that then, they will eventually get tired. I think what will happen is that as the new administration moves along, the popular uprising, which really is the winner on the whole political change, it's in control, and Trump just happens to be the head of it, and it looks like he's making some pretty good executive decisions in cabinet appointments as they go through. So now the next question, Chris, is how much of this great political change and pro-business stance is in the market? Well, I think quite a bit. So we can have, I've called it rational exuberance. You recall back in 1996 when valuations were getting extremely stretched. That was December that year, wasn't it, when Greenspan, then chairman of the Fed, noted that he thought this was irrational exuberance. Well, that was 96, and that bull market went on to 2000. But because of the constructive pro-business change, we thought that moving up on it really is rational exuberance, and it is exuberance. So on some key sectors, we've got our upside exhaustions, which is readings, which relates to momentum. We've got that in the banks, and we had it in the transports. And then the other backup we've got on that is another model, which we call the sequential, and it's been giving sequential sells, and that's a pattern. So you got two things saying it's a very good top. That was momentum related and pattern related. So we're looking now for a rounded top in the stock, in the big stock market. It could take a number of months. Now, when to go back to your question about gold, in previous post-bubble contractions, as I've said, the gold sector does very well, and it does opposite to what's going on in the ordinary sector. And so there has been a little opposite here going on, and it's constructive. So like the gold stocks, and you realize, of course, there will be some swings in them. They also could be vulnerable to when the first serious downdraft in the big stock market comes in. But again, as I said, Chris, we like the gold stocks.
Very good. Well, I'd like to discuss an interesting development that Doug Casey brought up after researching the World Gold Council recently. I found this rather surprising. Now, we all know that China, number one gold importer and producer, for that matter, so number one consumer, India just nipping at its heels, and for the longest time, the number one consumer of gold, of the yellow metal. But another key region, not an individual nation, the next most ravenous consumer of the precious metals, and that is the Middle East, because of the Islamic laws against trading and certain types of commodities, which gold, incidentally, is included within. Because it is a major consumer, there is some interesting aspects to the story that Doug Casey brought up recently. Due to certain Sharia law issues and other legalities, gold is very difficult to trade in the Middle East. In many, many areas, it's virtually impossible for even institutions to procure the metal in any size or build a position. Well, all of that, according to Doug Casey's research, will change in this March. The World Gold Council and, I want to say, another key organization are working with the Islamic interests to make it remarkably simple for anyone to procure gold without breaking any of the Sharia laws or any of the Muslim traditions. And this supposedly will open up, you might say, the floodgates of at least $3 trillion. Now, he thinks that could occur immediately. I would propose that it might take a bit longer than by April of this year that we'll see $3 trillion flood in. But here's some interesting metrics. There are currently 112 billionaires in that region. Many folks know there is a long history and tradition penchant for the yellow metal in the Middle East. If you look at the bigger picture here, considerably more gold pours into the Middle East than the United States. It is entirely possible that the Middle East as a region might even eclipse, you know, the rousing tiger nation as well as India in gold consumption in the years to come. Do you care to give us your outlook on Doug Casey's work and perhaps some of the minutiae of this developing story?
Sure. I got my start as an independent researcher in 1976. Gosh, Chris, that's a while ago. With a couple of the big mining firms in Vancouver taking on our research, or at that time it was my research, on a retainer basis. I learned a lot about mining companies and supply and demand and all that sort of stuff. And the main thing I learned was that nobody can do supply and demand analysis on any metal. It's a great frustration and is best avoided. So where I was able to get the start with these big mining companies was because I could provide them with a method of anticipating price changes in metal prices. And that's what it's really all about. So they were trying to do it with analyzing supply and demand, which is never accurate. It's always a way behind the market prices. And I've just found it, well, sometimes amusing, but most of the time I just try and avoid it and also try to explain to people that it just doesn't work. You want to go back, Doug Casey may be very good at it, but the guy that was the best and the most thorough and the most intensive, and it didn't work. He did not catch the bear market in gold after 2011. He thought he had every ounce of gold nailed down and that there was some sort of massive shortage, but it's an accounting thing. It's not a market thing, and it's very dangerous to go from supply demand to try and figure out what the price is going to do. So there's my thought. I've met with him at a number of the mining forums and stuff, and he's a fun guy. He's a really good guy, but forget about supply demand on any metal.
There was an interesting article, Why Silver Could Advance Sharply in 2017. Several topics that are brought up here, including the incumbent president, the change of the guard, if you will, or regime change in the White House. Apparently, this author is convinced that inflation could become a much more compelling story. The Brexit and other imminent exits from the EU, including, let's say, Italy, potentially France. Few folks are talking about, but it looks as though its days in the Eurozone could be limited as well. I'd like your thoughts on these two issues, as whether or not the new administration and the threat of more exits from the EU could boost the demand for the safe haven metals.
First of all, you mentioned inflation. I assume you mean CPI inflation. Don't see anything going out of control there. This business expansion is getting mature. Somewhere it could weaken. I don't see CPI inflation as a problem. And you're in a strange world when you got the Federal Reserve, which spent all through the 1970s and 80s saying that inflation was not a problem. And then when it did become a problem, they weren't part of the problem. And now they're trying to get inflation up to 2%, and perhaps they're getting there, but I don't expect it to last. It's not as if there's any shortages of goods and services out there, and we should recall that Friedman said that forever inflation is a monetary thing, but he didn't get into the concept of inflation in financial assets, and this is what we have had. You've had the biggest bond bubble in history. There's never been anything like it, where in one particular country, Germany, you got rates down to effectively zero, then you got near-term maturities trading at a minus rate. This has been where the huge inflation has been in. It's been inflation in bond prices. And without that inflation in bond prices, the Fed and other central bankers wouldn't have been able to get the credit out. And this is one of the things, I wrote a piece a few years ago called Inflation is Instantaneous. So the gold bugs think that when the Fed is being irresponsible, that the and it's not inflation now, inflation will happen later on. But when the Fed needs speculation in some kind of an asset in order to be reckless, and the speculation has been in bonds. It hasn't been in gold and silver. Not since the big blow-off in those items in 2011. So what one should be concerned about is a liquidity problem in the global bond market, which, by the way, using the U.S. long-dated treasuries, it did a very dramatic and highly technical blow-off last July, and from which, you know, bond prices have sold off. But this is just early stuff. So, yeah, the idea of now worrying about CPI inflation is not a worry. One should be very concerned about where the inflation has been, which has been in the bond market. And as it starts to come down, and if it really gets a liquidity problem, it's going to kill everything out there. And again, what will happen is that in a deflation, gold's real price traditionally has gone up, then that makes the gold mining business one of the premier industries in a world of weak prices for most businesses and industry and that sort of thing. So, Chris, what we're looking at here is some convictions on the part of critics of central banking that have been in the street as long as I've been, since the 1960s. I guess Dines was the first one to come out and start talking about inflation and all that sort of stuff. And now the whole of the world realizes that there is such a thing as CPI inflation. But the important thing is that CPI inflation hasn't been a problem since 1981, when the CPI rate of inflation peaked at, 14 or 15%. The long bond went to trading at 15% yield, and now it's got down to, almost 2%. This is where the action's been. So The danger is not CPI inflation. That will not drive gold prices up. The danger is a collapsing bond market, and which was the big action of, well, since 2011, when base metals and precious metals headed south. So again, the phrase I've used has been inflation is instantaneous, and it's whatever the action is on the big game, and the big game has bonds, and the big game bonds is coming apart. So there's where the big deflation will be in bond prices.
The Fed has the magic pen. They have carte blanche authority to create as much additional debt as possible, where they could, you know, step in, continue to absorb their own toxic debt, the Treasury market. Nevertheless, eventually, we all know the music has to stop.
Just a minute, I'm going to back up a bit on this, Chris, because this is an elusive concept. The rising bond prices permitted the Fed to be reckless. In the 1970s, rising commodity prices and wage prices permitted the Fed to be reckless. So, and then when the commodities started to crash in 1981, that then set up the world of financial asset inflation, just the same as when commodities soared in 1920, crashed in 1921, the Federal Reserve then was easy on the money markets because they were afraid of commodities going down further. That was through the 1920s. But they didn't understand that the credit would eventually go into the financial markets, where then you had the 1929 bubble. So same thing this time. Commodities blew out in 1980-81. Then the action shifted over, where you had the Fed under Volcker did not tighten at all. If you take a look at money supply figures, they continued to grow, but you had a crash in commodities and the start of inflation in financial assets, of which the game has been, the big game has been in the global bond markets, and that's ending action. So when the bond prices come down, the Fed will not be permitted to be reckless anymore. So it's, you have to really dwell on cause and effect. The Fed ease did not cause commodities to speculate in the 1970s and 80s. That was speculation in commodities allowed the Fed to expand credit. And the same thing of recent, where the bubble in financial assets has allowed the Fed to be reckless. So keep in mind that an old saying I've had is that the Fed cannot depreciate the dollar at will. Most gold bugs think that it can. But hey, the dollar's been going up since 2009. Also, that is one of the features of a post-bubble contraction is a firming senior currency, which we're getting. And it's had a correction here the last week, but it's getting prepared to make another major move up.
Well, let's move on to another interesting gold pundit, of course, Jim Rickards, an outspoken proponent of the yellow metal in recent years, calling for a minimum of 10% allocation into one's portfolio of gold and silver investments, anticipating a cash ban. You might think of it as a banking holiday, sort of echoing what's occurring right now in Modi's India. We might eventually find the ATM, Bob, is empty.
Oh, yeah. I know the gold guys have gone wild over what happened in England, India. That's an atrocity what their government is doing. But in the U.S. now, the change is going to be away from, they're going to audit the Fed. They're going to watch this thing. And also the Fed is going to be seen not to work. So now, Rickard, I see his stuff, and he always prompts my curiosity because I remember something in the summer. There was some great event was going to happen late in September, and subscribers would be advised. And, you know, I don't remember anything special coming out, and then again, the date for something great that he knows the secret of is going to come out in December. I don't know. I should keep a little blotter on those statements about sensational things happening and then not happening.
Another interesting topic that we've seen in the headlines recently, shares in companies, i.e. stock shares, simply are no longer the predominant investment vehicle traded on their specific exchange. In other words, ETFs, exchange-traded funds, which you might think of as an actively traded mutual fund, where one can buy shares in virtually any index that you could imagine being thrown together. GBTC, I believe, is the ticker of the Bitcoin ETF, which, of course, is run by the Winklevoss twins, are now famous or infamous, illustrated in the movie regarding Facebook. Nevertheless, the point simply is here that we have too many exchange-traded funds, or maybe it's not way too many. Maybe this is the future. Maybe this is the way to invest.
Oh, yeah. Every bull market in equities creates instruments. And even the South Sea bubble in 1720, they were right off the bat with creating option things. And then if the first financial market letter writer was a guy by the name of Houghton in London in the 1690s. And he's talking about options, puts, and they don't call them puts and calls then, they call them puts and refusals. And he talks about all this trading on that was wild, and he even has one delightful paper called The Mystery of Buying More Than All, where there was only so many options issued on a company, and the street had bought more than existed, so there was a huge short squeeze there. So option strategies, ETFs, all of these time bargain things, they've been around since modern financial history began in the 1690s. So they are a feature of a highly speculative period.
All of the early bubbles, I think, were punctuated by these peculiar instruments. I seem to recall reading during the tulip mania in Amsterdam, and around Holland, the original idea of the futures contract came into play, because as I'm sure listeners know, the tulips did not breed true, just like in the IPO mania days of the late 1990s, where people were fascinated by internet companies. Which one will become Netflix, will become Amazon, will become Google? Yeah, the next Netscape. In similar fashion, the variegated, highly desirable one could come from virtually any bulb. So there was a great speculative frenzy. And of course, very peculiar types of instruments would crop up, sort of mirroring the ETFs here. So in your opinion then, Bob, this remarkable stock market rally, which has, I guess, catapulted the Dow in the neighborhood of 20,000, and the NASDAQ, I'm sure, has either eclipsed or has come close to eclipsing its year 2000 bubble peak. Is this going to lead us to, remember, the fabled 24,000 Dow target, or is this the ultimate zenith for the market?
Yeah, good question, Chris. But those targets, wasn't one of them 35,000 Dow? And whoever was using it was using a compound growth rate of 6% or something like that. It wasn't. On the overall stock market, we have a couple of tools we use. One is relates to momentum. And at market peaks, you get a number of what we call upside exhaustions. And this is what we have been getting on this rally in the S&P, all in the bank stocks, in the transport. So that shows a high degree of speculation and momentum. The other one we use is pattern, and we call that, in this case, a sequential sell. And in those things I mentioned, we've got sequential sells as well. So the greatest change in political history to a pro-business government is for the moment in the market. And it's going to take some while to implement a pro-business government, and also to, hey, here's a new word, de-implement a lot of the arbitrary intrusive stuff that the authoritarians have been using. So it is good times, but also, like, there was some small business index enthusiasm is the highest it's been since November 1980 when Reagan won, and that was a pro-business situation. So a lot of the good stuff forthcoming is in the market, and I think the safest thing to say, we could have a correction from here. As a matter of fact, since we've been talking, the Dow has gone from down 40 to down 100. So a correction, but it would be within, let's call it a rounded top, where maybe crude oil being reasonably good out to March is a possible. Maybe credit spreads haven't changed yet. So what we're looking for is speculative high now, or a few weeks ago, actually, something positive to keep it together on the right-hand shoulder side of a rounding top pattern. So but this is what we used in 2015, was a rounding top pattern, and it turned out to work quite well. Now, also in 2015, you had a speculative blow-off in Shanghai market, and on our work then, we needed the third upside exhaustion reading, and we got that in June, so that call was straightforward. Now, the rebound in Shanghai has not been nearly as dramatic, but it is giving some, it gave us some breathing. You could say it's way overbought, so there's a probability. Yield curve has started to turn. Credit spreads are not yet started to turn. So let's call the stock market precarious.
Bring in one last piece to this puzzle as we wrap up. I think overlooked somewhat the importance to the mutual fund flows into the equities market that keep sending shares higher that aren't coming from, let's say, the EU, you know, or both sides of the ponds, if you will, Japan, Asia, and the EU fleeing those regions. But here domestically, at least on paper, it appears that the bulk of those funds flowing in come from the biweekly or monthly paycheck automatically sent over into pension funds and related mutual funds that then have to remain invested in this sector, the only sector that's really producing anything right now of interest to the typical investor. But what happens when the economy starts to turn around and incomes begin to shrivel up? You know, without that constant or at least continuous flow of funds and investment capital, will we be able to sustain, you know, this 8-9 year bull market in equities, or will folks start to look around for more solid investments like the safe havens?
It's price that determines a bull or bear market, and the flows follow. So again, we just look at the action in the big market has become toppy, but there are events in credit spreads, for example, that have yet to happen. The reversal in the yield curve is already a warning on the bank stocks. So things are coming into place for a top.
The only thing I'd add in here as we close is that, you take a look at the Dow, the S&P, the major U.S. equities indexes from, let's say, late 2014 all the way through 2015 and 2016, there was every chance that the peak was in place. Just like old turkey from reminiscences, shares keep making new highs. And, you know, as long as an index continues making new highs and relatively higher lows, we can see this market run many years longer than most of the bears can remain solvent.
We're not calling for a peak of the bull market now. We're looking for another rounded top. At some point, the credit excesses will become, hey, when's the settlement date, or immense. At some point, you go into a cyclical credit contraction. But all we can do now on the stock market is to say that it looks like it's building a rounded top and let it work out over the next number of months. But listen, I'll add one more little thing to your bit about the tulip mania in Holland, which was the commercial and financial center of the world. Now, when they started trading the tulip bulbs, these were by non-professionals. They were, let's call them, as we used to, odd lotters. They were trading them in taverns. Now, the authorities, I guess, in Amsterdam, said and uttered warnings that these were unenforceable contracts. outside of the financial system, whereas inside they had a clearing means where then contracts were enforceable. But they were very clear to say that the tulips were unenforceable contracts and watch out. And then it went.
Those who don't learn the lessons of history, doomed to repeat it. We're looking forward to plenty of comments and commentary and insightful historical tidbits in 2017. Please tell people more about Institutional Advisors.
Yeah, you can get in touch with us. We got the website, institutionaladvisors.com. Or you can just Google my name, Bob Hoy, H-O-Y-E, and it all comes up. And you can get into the website, see our history, see the methods that we use, and take a subscription.
Sounds great. Bob Hoy, we appreciate your thoughts. Talk soon.
Very good, Chris. Next time.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.